technically true.
How are you feeling?
He probes. He doesn't want to push it, but he's still uneasy. I can tell. I'm fine, honey, seriously. Don't worry about me, I'm absolutely fine. I tell him I love him, and he tells me he loves me too. When I feel confident enough with the gun, I clean it thoroughly again and apply silver duct tape from Mark's toolbox to the gun's handle. The checked grip sections on gun butts can't retain prints, but the smooth areas at the front and back can. The internet tells me that it will be easier to pull the duct tape off after firing than it would be to wipe the gun down after an altercation. I know myself well enough to know I won't be thinking straight after that happens. If that happens. The tape will help. I leave Mark a note on the stairs in the hallway. He'll get back from New York tomorrow night, and I won't be here. The note says, I love him with all my heart. I'm sorry about the mess. I didn't want to stay in the house alone, and I'll sleep over at Caro's that night. Not to worry, I'll see him soon. I start to gather what I'll need from the shambles that is our home. I download a GPS coordinate location app onto my phone. I'll need it to find the coordinates of the meeting location. I fill a rucksack with the gun, bullets, phone, and USB. I pack a change of clothes, toiletries, an old yellow travel alarm clock I've had since I was a kid, my hiking clothes and boots, and a flashlight. As I wander the house gathering these items, I wonder at what stage all of this started. If I could wind it back, how far back would I have to wind? To before I turned on the phone? To before we opened the bag? To the circle of floating papers? To the wedding? To the day Mark called me from the men's loo? Would that be far enough? Chapter 35. Friday, September the 30th. Point and squeeze. At 7 a.m, I pack the car and go. The road to Norfolk is nearly empty, the soft mumble of Radio 4 filling the car as I work things through in my head. Norfolk, I figure, is my safest bet. It's isolated. There's no real police presence. I know my way through those woods, and there's no CCTV. No one will be watching me. If someone follows me, I'm sure I'll know it. I pull over on the hard shoulder of the motorway and text the number again from my phone. I specify only a time for tomorrow and a general location. I will send more detailed GPS coordinates on the morning of the meeting. Mark's not leaving from New York until this evening, and he won't get back to our house until after midnight tonight. I try not to picture his face, his eyes when he sees me tomorrow morning, when I finally get home after all this is over. He'll know I've been lying to him. He'll know I wasn't at Caro's, he's not an idiot. And I'll have to tell him everything. I promise myself that once this is over, I'll be honest. I'll never lie again. I'll be the best wife in the world. I promise. I've booked a hotel room. It's not the same hotel we stayed in before. It's one I've never been to. I plan to stay just one night. I've set the meeting time for 6 tomorrow morning, and they've confirmed. I also received a new voicemail. The same male voice as before. He wants me to hand over the coordinates for the downed plane tomorrow, too. That's part of the deal now. Luckily, I have that information. They'll be able to get here by the meeting time tomorrow, wherever they are. A private jet flight from most places in the world would only take a few hours, not days. Russia is a 4-hour flight. They have more than enough time to get here, wherever they're coming from. I've chosen an isolated area to meet, in the woods, and I've chosen 6 a.m, because the earlier the better. I don't want any interruptions. I'll have enough to worry about as it is. My backpack lies across the back seat of my car, my thick coat draped protectively over it. Inside, a small bag of emergency food and a bottle of water. It's cold out, and there's a lot to be done today. The memory stick is nestled in the rucksack's front zip pocket. Safe, easy to access. In the internal computer compartment of the rucksack, the gun waits in its case, next to the bullets and the phone. Everything I need for tomorrow. I get to the hotel at 10 a.m. I have no more voicemails. Check-in runs smoothly. The receptionist is sweet, but this is obviously a gap-year job. She's totally uninterested, which works out perfectly for me with the hours I'll be keeping. My room is small and cozy. The bed is a thick, deep nest of crisp cotton sheets and down feathers. There's a gleaming copper tub in the bathroom. Very nice. Perfect. I double-check I have the flash drive and gun, slip on my thick outdoor coat, pull on my backpack, and head out. I'm going to walk the route for tomorrow's meeting. According to my phone's GPS, I can get the whole way to the woods without using any roads. That's the safest option, if I stick to the fields and woods. It takes me an hour at a brisk walking pace to reach the woodland area I'm after. I'll need to make a note of two sets of GPS coordinates on my phone for the exchange. I'll send the first one, the meeting point, once I've set off tomorrow. It would be silly to give them extra time to look around before we meet in the morning. The second set of coordinates is for the exact location of the USB. I'm going to bury the USB today, near the meeting point. Once they give me the money, once it hits our Swiss account, I'll text them the second set of coordinates just like Eddie said. This way, I'll avoid a direct face-to-face confrontation. After that, I will finally text them the plane coordinates. And then we're done. I chose this area because I know it's isolated. Mark and I have hiked through these woods enough times. You can walk half the day without ever coming across another person. The only noises this far from the village are the sounds of things scuttling in the undergrowth and the distant crack of rifle shots carried on the wind. No one thinks twice about gunshots out here. It's part of everyday life. Another reason I chose this spot. I'm deep in the woods, about 20 minutes walk to the nearest B road. I shrug off the backpack and carefully remove the gun box. I take an A4 sheet of paper out of the back section of the bag, the hotel welcome letter, and a thumbtack that I pocketed from the tourist information board in the hotel lobby. I pin the sheet of paper to the widest tree in the clearing. I need to practice. I need to at least fire the bloody thing before I point it at a person. Eddie mentioned backup. Don't do it without backup. Well, this is my backup. I have one magazine preloaded with 15 bullets, plus another fresh pack in a little cardboard box. That makes 27 bullets. Simon didn't scrimp on bullets, thank God. Perhaps he guessed I'd need the practice. I'll need a full mag for the meeting, in case I do actually need to use the gun. So, here's a maths problem for you. If Erin wants to keep a mag's worth of ammo for tomorrow, how much ammo can Erin use today? Erin can use 12 bullets today. 12 practice shots to work with. I carefully remove 3 bullets from my full mag and place them safely with the fresh 12-pack in the pocket of my rucksack. Hopefully, I won't need to put this practice session in use at all tomorrow, but I'd rather be over-prepared than under. I slide the mag back in, hold the gun out in front of me, arms extended, the gun leveled in front of my dominant eye. I line up the white dot and the box that make up the Glock's sights with the paper target on a tree ahead. I've been warned in the videos about the kickback on Glocks, but the stance you're supposed to adopt to counteract it isn't what you'd expect. Not like you've seen on TV. Not like you've seen in films. You stand straight on, not to the side, not like a side-stepping, flashlight-carrying FBI cadet. Your feet need to be hip-width apart, knees soft, my right hand on the grip, my trigger finger along the barrel, safely away from the trigger, my left hand held high, bracing the right on the grip, shoulders forward, elbows locked. You might not look cool, but you will hit what you're aiming for. At least, that's the idea. I breathe. Slow in. slow out. It will be loud. So much louder than you'd expect. It will kick, buck back against you like a punch. But you need to stay solid. Give slightly, but hold your ground. I inhale deeply. Slide my finger into the trigger well. Exhale and pull. The crack rips through the woods around me. The gun kicks back like a grown man slamming into me. My heart explodes with adrenaline. My eyes are dazzled. Astonishingly, I hold my position. I am fine. Ahead of me, I see the very edge of the paper shredded. A large clump of bark splintered upwards at a crazy angle. I got it. If that were a man, I'd have got him. An odd flush of joy. I shake it off and focus. I realign. And then I pull the trigger 11 more times. By the end of the afternoon, there's no paper left and the tree is a mess. I decide perhaps I'll walk a little further before I note down a GPS location. I definitely don't want them to see this tree. I find a good spot another 5 minutes in, a small muddy clearing. I jot down the GPS coordinates from the app into my iPhone notes. Then I try to find another location where I'll actually bury the USB in the plastic bag. I choose a distinctive oak tree away from the clearing near a ditch. I should be safe to hide there unseen tomorrow. I squat down by the oak and dig a small hole in the topsoil with my bare hands. I place the USB in its little plastic bag in the ground and cover it over with soil and leaves, blending it back into the forest floor. I note the coordinates of where it's buried on my iPhone, and then I head back to the hotel. In my hotel room, I lay everything out for tomorrow. I test my travel alarm clock a couple of times, and miraculously, it still works. I set it for 4:30 a.m. and place it on the nightstand next to the hotel's ornate bedside lamp. I place the gun and remaining ammo in the safe. After ordering room service, I ring Mark's mobile, but it runs straight to voicemail. "Hi, Mark, it's me. I guess you've already taken off. I just wanted you to know everything's fine. I'm fine. I miss you. I love you. Listen, the house is an absolute tip, by the way, just to warn you. I'll tidy it tomorrow. Safe flight. Love you. See you soon. Can't wait." I hang up. When he gets home, he'll get my note on the stairs saying I'm staying over at Caro's tonight. I hope this all works. I really do. My food comes and I eat in silence. No TV or music for company. I think of Eddie and Lottie, of Holly and her friend Ash out there somewhere, who knows where. I think of Mark in his plane high over the Atlantic, of the people in their plane deep under the South Pacific. I think of Alexa and her potential pregnancy, how happy she must be. I think of what I'm carrying inside myself. I'm in kind of a daze, but I force myself to eat for what's growing there. I need to look after us both better. With that in mind, after dinner, I run a hot bubble bath in the roll-top tub and lower myself slowly into its soft warmth. I let the heat soak in, and I let my mind wander as I stare absent-mindedly at the etched, frosted glass section of the bathroom door. Entwined climbing flowers and engraved wild birds. A forest scene. It's pretty. This is a lovely hotel. Mark would like it here. Or maybe he wouldn't. After all, right now I'm doing the exact thing I absolutely promised him I would not do. And with that thought, I rise, red-skinned from the water, towel myself off, and prepare to get an early night. Chapter 36. Saturday, October the 1st. Something in the dark. My eyes shoot open in the darkness. I can't see anything in the thick black except the dull glow of the alarm clock's luminous hands. I don't know what's woken me, but it was sudden. Now I am wide awake. Something is not right in the darkness. There's someone in the room with me. I can feel it. I'm not sure how long I've been asleep, but the light is no longer spilling from the edges of the curtains. The gun is where I left it, tucked away in the safe, in the wardrobe. I would never get to it in time. I should have kept it out. Should have, would have, could have. I can't hear anything. No movement. No sound but the muffled tuck, tuck of the plastic clock. Then a rustle, a brush of fabric in the right-hand corner. Oh, shit, shit, shit. There is someone here. There's someone in my room. Adrenaline instantly fizzes through my system, through the other tiny heart inside me. Absolute fear. It takes every fiber of my being to stop myself from leaping up. I freeze. I realize that whoever they are, they believe I'm asleep. That gives me time to think, to plan. Maybe if I don't move, they'll leave. They'll just take what they want and go. Except I'm not sleeping. It seems impossible they'd not sense the change in the air now, suddenly thick with terror. The soft rustling sound comes again. What are they doing? What should I do? Am I going to die here in a weekend getaway hotel alone? Is that the way you want to go, Erin? Think. I keep my breathing low, deep, as if I'm still asleep. It's him. It's the man on the other end of the phone. It must be. They've found me. Was it the last text I sent? The one with tomorrow's meeting location? I think desperately about how that could have happened, but I don't know how. My mind won't focus. And does it matter? He's tracked me down somehow. Oh, God, I'm such an idiot. There's no way he'll just take what he wants and leave me sleeping. I know this. I know this because what he wants isn't here. It's buried in the woods. He won't just leave me. He'll have to wake me up eventually. And he'll make me tell him where it is. I'm going to die. He'll do it quietly. Perhaps he'll smother me with a pillow or hold me down in the bath. Something that looks accidental. Something that'll raise no suspicions, as if he were never here. My chest screams under the tension of controlling and slowing my breath. My fingers are itching to crawl through the dark to my phone charging on the bedside table. Sweat soaks my t-shirt under the heavy duck-down duvet. I need to think. I don't want to die. The sound of a zip. I can't ignore it. I can't ignore this sound. It's too loud. I let out a heavy sigh and turn in the bed, disturbed but not awake. He pauses. What the fuck is he unzipping? Think, 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 think. I need to use the element of surprise. It's all I've got. If I can surprise him, hit him with something, something hard, just once, then I'll have the upper hand. One good swing. But what? A fucking pillow? There's a glass of water by the lamp. I could throw that. And what, Erin? Get him a bit wet? Okay, maybe not. The lamp? I remember. It's a big Baroque thing, metal with a marble base. Yes, if I grab and yank hard enough, the plug might pull out as I swing. The noises are coming from over by the bathroom door now, near my backpack. Suddenly, my phone, sitting innocently on the bedside table, lights up in the darkness of the room. The rustling stops and both of us turn our eyes to the light. I catch a glimpse of the text in that split second. It's Mark. I know where you are, I'll be... But I don't have time to read the rest. The man in my room knows I'm awake. It's now or never. I squeeze my eyes shut, tense my palms against the mattress, and push myself up and over to the side table. A sudden burst of movement races towards me. He's running at me. I scramble for the lamp and swing blindly towards the intruder with all my might, my full weight behind it. I feel the tension and the pull of the plug coming away from the socket, followed by the dull thump of the marble base grazing flesh. A guttural shout. He stumbles back, away from me. A curse. You fucking bitch! The voice is low, filled with hate, but there's something familiar about it. He comes at me again. In the darkness, I can't tell how close he is or if he has a weapon. All I can do is swing again. I swing with all my strength. It connects. Marble on bone, a wet, smacking sound. He stumbles. I hear his labored breathing, low to the floor now. He's on his knees. I need light. I need to see what's going on, to see him, to find out if he has a weapon. I sprint towards the bathroom door and fumble inside for the switch. The cool bathroom light floods the room. There he is, crouched at the end of the bed, hand to head, dark hair, black coat. He's white, large, strong. I can't see his face. Is there stubble, a beard? The lamp still hangs in my hand, ready, a glimmering smear of blood across its base. He's coming round now. He raises his face slowly to the light. I falter. It's Patrick. The man from outside the prison. I wasn't paranoid. He has been following me. And now I know. He's definitely not SO15. He's definitely not police. Blood runs from the fresh wound above his eyes, streaming down his face, smeared in his hair. He swipes it away from his eyes, looks up at me, blank, cold. There's only one way this is going to end. I can't believe how stupid I've been. I think of all the mistakes I've made. I should have seen this coming. A huge wave of nausea breaks over me. I'm going to die. My heart thunders in my ears, my knees buckle, and as I'm falling, he lurches towards me. I lose consciousness. Chapter 37, Saturday, October the 1st. Mark is coming. When I open my eyes, all I see is white. I'm sprawled on the bathroom floor, the bright ceiling lights glaring, my cheek pressed the cold white tile. I bolt upright, but I'm alone. The bathroom door is shut. There is only darkness visible through the ornate glass that makes up its top half. My head spins from the sudden movement. On the side of the basin next to me, blood. A long, ugly smear. A half-handprint. There's pain coming from the side of my head, and when I touch my forehead, my hand comes back dark red and gummy. He must have smashed my head into the porcelain washbasin. A blow to the head. Head wounds bleed a lot, I've heard. Or perhaps I saw it in a film, I can't remember. But it means they're often not as serious as they look, right? Then again, I could have a concussion. I try to estimate the damage, the pain. It feels like I'm drunk and hungover all at the same time. I think of the baby and put my hand to my stomach, and then quickly down between my legs. My fingers come away without blood this time. No blood, no miscarriage. Thank God. Be safe in there, little one. Please be okay. I pull myself over to the door, head throbbing, waves of nausea. I can't hear anything coming from the next room. I gingerly wipe the sting of sweat and blood away from my eyes with my t-shirt. Then I press my ear to the door and I wait. Nothing. I think he's gone. I pray he's gone. I don't know how long I've been unconscious, but it must have been a while. The blood on the white tiles has crusted and dried. I rise up slightly to kneel and peer into the dark glass of the door. There's no movement in the next room. I try the door handle, but I know it's locked even before I pull back. The small metal key that's usually on the inside of the bathroom door isn't there anymore. He's locked me in. I try the handle again. Solid. I'm trapped. He wants to keep me here. He's gone, but he wants me to stay, in case they can't find the USB. That's the only reason I'm still alive. He'll be back, after he's got what he needs. Who is Patrick? Is he the man on the other end of the phone? Whoever he is, I now know he's working for whoever owned that bag. I've lost. They have everything. My phone with the location coordinates was by the bed. They'll know to look for something as obvious as my phone. With enough time, they'll find the GPS coordinates for the USB on it, and they'll check both areas in that clearing until they find it. I've led them straight there. I need to get out of here before they come back. I need to walk away from this. Leave all of it. Go home. Run. Then Mark and I can call the police. We'll explain everything. At this stage, I don't care what the consequences of that may be. We can work that out later. Maybe we can bargain with the information we have. Either way, we need police protection now. I don't want to end up like the Sharps. But then I remember Mark's text. He is on his way. Where? Here. But how can he know where I am? How can he know I'm here in Norfolk? I thought he might work out what I was up to once he got home, but how can he know it's happening here? I rack my brain, and then I remember. It's so simple. About 3 years ago, I lost my mobile phone after a night out, and when I got a new phone, Mark installed a phone finder app for me so that we could track the new one if I ever lost it. All he needed to do was open up my laptop at home and click on the app, and bing, there I am. And he's on his way here to meet me right now. Thank God. We'll ring the police as soon as he gets here, and he should be here very soon. And then it hits me. He won't be coming here. He'll be going wherever my phone is. Oh my God. He'll be going straight to them. I have to stop him. I have to get to where they are before he does. I have to warn him or he'll walk right into it. I need to save him. This is all my fault. I shake the bathroom door hard this time. I'm trapped. I hear myself let out a muted whimper of frustration. I peer through the empty keyhole. The key's not on the other side either. No key to poke out of the lock and onto the floor and pull under the door like they do in movies. Patrick has tossed it, or taken it. I look up at the window and the door. The intricately engraved birds of paradise, frozen in song above me. I rise clumsily to my feet as the bathroom spins sickeningly around me. I wait for the burst of dizziness to pass. I grab a thick hotel towel off the rail and wrap it around the ceramic soap dish. Hopefully the noise won't wake anyone. I turn on the shower to muffle the sound just in case. A rain of glass smashes and patters across the bathroom tiles and the plush carpet of the bedroom. Shards pepper across my cheeks and my hair. I turn off the shower and hold my breath. Listen. I hear nothing. No doors open along the corridor. No voices. I drag the bathroom bin over to the door and step carefully onto it, laying another towel over the jagged window frame to protect myself from cuts. Then I clamber as quickly as I can through the shattered window back into the main room. As expected, my mobile phone is gone. Ignoring the fresh cut I've opened on my arm, I run to the bedside phone to call Mark to warn him. But then I stop. I can't call Mark. His number is on my iPhone. I don't know it by heart. Modern technology. I don't even know my husband's phone number. I wish more than anything I had memorized it, but I haven't. So I can't call him. I can't warn him. The only way I can reach Mark now is to go to the buried USB coordinates myself. I need to go there and find Mark and warn him before it's too late. I need to stop him from following my phone right into the middle of all this, right into danger. I scan the room. My rucksack is gone, damn it. But it's something else that makes me pause. The safe door is open. And the safe is empty. This throws me. That's where the Glock was. It's gone. How did Patrick know the code? But of course, I always use the same code. I use the code we have at home. The one that's so easy to figure out, it's laughable. Mark's birthday. Maybe Patrick did come to our house that day. Either way, somehow he knew Mark's date of birth. He must have gone through the obvious choices and then struck gold. And now I have no gun. I have no gun, no phone, no plan. There's broken glass on the carpet. There's blood on the bedspread. We've made quite a mess here. I'll have to clean it up at some point, but right now I don't have time. The clock on the bedside cabinet reads 4:18. It will go off in 12 minutes. I slam the off button and toss it onto the bed. I need to take it with me. It's the only way I've got of telling the time now. In the mirror, the top left corner of my forehead on the hairline is red, swollen, crusted with black. For a second, feeling overwhelmed, I think about calling the police, sending them to the woods. But I need to get Mark away from there first. I don't want him caught in the chaos of police gunfire. Instead, I dress hastily, jam shoes on, and then pull on the beanie hat that will cover the rest of the mess Patrick has made of my head. 12 minutes later, I silently lift the latch on the front entrance of the hotel. The Do Not Disturb sign, left hanging on the door to my highly incriminating room, is the only thing between me and police interference. It will take me an hour to get to that spot in the woods, and I have no phone to call Mark, or Eddie, or anyone else who might help. No GPS to guide me, and no plan of what I'll do when and if I get there. Just one simple thought. Save Mark. It's still dark outside. My breath fogs in the air. 5 a.m. is already the sort of hour that prompts you to question your life choices. This morning, that feeling is particularly apt. I really have made bad choices in my life, but at least now that I know that, I'm in a position to rectify them. With no phone or watch, I have to rely on the little plastic alarm clock. If I run, it should half my time. I run. I run for a long time. At 5:43, I start to panic. I've made my way as far as the tiny lay-by on the B road. I must have passed the spot and missed it. I head back into the forest. At 5:57, I hear voices. They're coming from the right, about 100 yards away over a sloped area. I drop to my knees and crawl up the slope to the top of the incline and peek over. In the clearing, two figures stand talking. No conflict, no guns in sight. I can't make out the figures in the pre-dawn light, but I listen. I inch closer, desperate to remain hidden, even as the leaves and forest debris crunch beneath my weight. The voices are clearer now, but something stops me short. That voice, I know it. I love it. It's Mark. Mark is here already. I want to leap up, charge into the clearing and into his arms. If he's in danger, we'll face it together. But something stops me. His tone. His voice is cautious, businesslike. He's clearly doing what he's told. I'm too late, shit. He must have run into them, trying to find me. They're making him help them find the USB. I slide further along the ridge. In the thin light, I see that Mark and another man are now down on their knees, scraping at the forest floor, leather gloves brushing through leaves, scrabbling soil. The second man has read the notes on my phone. He knows I buried the USB, and now he's making Mark help him look for it. He has both sets of coordinates. It's only a matter of minutes before they find it. Shit. I need to think of some way to get Mark out of this. Then, in the half-light, I see the face of the man holding my phone. I bite back a gasp. This man isn't Patrick. This is not the man who attacked me in my hotel room. Panic jolts through me. There's more of them. Does Mark know? Where is Patrick? I chance a glance behind me, but the wood is deathly silent. Has Patrick gone? Has he done his part and left, or is he out in the darkness somewhere, keeping watch? Mark and the man stand and wander over to another patch of the clearing. This new man is taller than Mark, his dark hair peppered with grey. Beneath his overcoat, I catch the glimpse of a suit and tie, expensively dressed, even as he slowly kneels near Mark and continues to search in the dirt and leaves. He reminds me of Eddie, but with a continental slant. This must be the man on the other end of the phone. I'm sure of it. Patrick has delivered my phone to him, and they've been looking for the USB ever since. My phone app must have led Mark straight to them, and now he's been forced to take part in their search too. Now I can see Mark's features, grim and determined as he scratches around on the forest floor. Is he wondering where I am? Is he scared? He's hiding it well, but I can still see the fear playing across his face. I know him so well. I know he's using all his will to hold it together. Maybe he has a plan. I remember the way he fooled the receptionist at the Four Seasons just a couple of weeks ago. How good he was at playing his character. He's smart. He'll have a plan. God, I hope he has a plan. I scan the clearing, desperate to come up with my own plan, but what can I do? I have no gun. I can't just charge in. I'd end up getting us both killed. I need to think of something. I have to stop what's happening before they find the USB and Mark becomes dispensable. Before Patrick comes back, if indeed he's out there. We can do this together, Mark and I, if I just think. I decide to crawl nearer to the USB. I've been able to use the darkness as cover, but the light is relentlessly building and I'll be exposed soon. I wriggle awkwardly back down the slope and towards the second GPS spot, to the tree I picked yesterday as my landmark, where the USB is buried. Their voices fade away, and I pray I'm right that the tall man won't do anything to Mark, at least until they found the USB. I find a spot out of sight, in the sunken hollow behind my tree, a perfect view of the GPS location. There's movement now. Snaps of twigs, footsteps coming closer. I press flat against the hard, cold ground. I can just see them over the crest of the ditch. They have given up in the first spot and are moving towards the second set of coordinates. They head right for me and sink to the ground to continue their search. They start digging in silence. Mark's so close to me now. I want to scream, run, Mark, please run. But I know our lives depend on me not doing something stupid like that. What's his plan? I don't know what to do. This is all my fault. God, he must be so worried about me. Where does he think I am? Does he think they have me? That they killed me? He's almost close enough to touch. I could just reach out, let him know that I'm here. It's then that Mark finds the USB. I see it happen in slow motion. He palms it and throws a glance over his shoulder to the tall man who continues searching, still oblivious. Good work, honey, I think. Come on, drop it in your pocket. Buy us some time. Hit him when he's not looking. But he doesn't do that. Mark doesn't do that, because what Mark does next astonishes me. Instead of pocketing the USB, he laughs. He laughs and holds it up. A child with treasure, his smile broad and genuine, delighted. He stands, brushing the leaves and muck off his knees. What is going on? The tall man nods, his face breaking into a tight smile. He tosses my iPhone down into the leaves near Mark's feet. He doesn't need it now. He's got what he wanted. Mark bends to pick it up. The tall man reaches into his pocket, and I strain to see what he's reaching for, praying not to see a familiar glint of gunmetal. No copies of the files, he asks Mark. I notice I'm trembling. The leaves around my arms rustle ever so slightly. Mark shakes his head. No copies, he says as he slips my phone safely into his pocket. Is Mark acting? I don't get it. I don't understand what's going on. The tall man nods, pleased. Something about Mark's tone of voice, his posture. This is not right. He doesn't sound scared. He doesn't even sound worried. What is he doing? Doesn't he know they'll kill him? Oh my God. I think Mark's plan is to try and do the deal. How has he managed that? What happened before I got here? What have I missed? Why would they do the deal when they already hold all the cards? The other man is on the phone now, talking in a language I don't understand, his tone curt. When he seems satisfied, he hangs up.
Done. Check your account, he tells Mark.
Mark pulls out another phone now, slowly, demonstratively, showing that it's not a weapon. He looks calm, fully in control, every inch the businessman. Not one part of him scared or panicked. I have this disconcerting thought. The two men look the same, the tall man and Mark, the same breed. The man looks off into the tree line.
Where is she, your wife? He asks conversationally.
I catch my breath. Careful, Mark. Don't be fooled. That man knows exactly where I am, where Patrick left me. Mark has no idea what they've done to me. No idea that Patrick attacked me and took everything. He knows they had my phone, though. He knows that's how he ended up here. He tracked it here. He'll know this is a trick question. Don't let them trap you. Mark scrolls and taps on the phone. He looks up briefly.
She doesn't know anything. I've taken care of her. Trust me. She won't be a problem anymore.
His voice is bored. His eyes flick lazily back down to the phone. That's right, Mark. Well played. God, he's good at this. I watch him as he scrolls away at his phone, waiting for the payment to come through. So calm. So together. But wait. Hang on. Something's wrong here. Why are they paying him? Why would they attack me and steal the coordinates and then still pay us? They have everything they want. Why pay Mark? I mean, Mark's not pointing a gun at them or anything. Why would they give him the money? A depth charge of sadness surges through me, leaving in its wake an emptiness the likes of which I've never known. And all at once, it all starts to make sense. Mark didn't come here to save me. He came here to stop me from making the deal. To take over the deal. He doesn't care what they've done to me. He doesn't care that they've hurt me. He doesn't care about me at all. And now he's doing the deal with them, behind my back. Oh God, Mark has made the trade for just himself. I want to cry out. I want to scream. I slap my gloved hand over my mouth because this man, standing here in the woods, is Mark, but it's not my Mark. This man is a stranger. My mind races over the facts. Who is this man I married? How long has he been lying to me? How did he do this? My mind retraces everything that's happened over the past month. When did this start? Mark was the only one who saw inside the plane. What did he see in the wreckage? It was Mark who left a trail that led to the Sharps. He's the reason those people are dead. It was Mark who sent me to set up the bank account, sent me to meet with Charles. Mark insisted no one was looking for us, or for the bag. He wanted to dump the diamonds. So he could sell them himself? He kept the voicemails about the USB a secret. He hid the USB from me. He wanted it for himself. He'd been covering his own tracks since we left Bora Bora, setting everything up so I've been the front man all along, but he can still access all the money without me. I'm numb with shock. I can't believe how stupid I've been. I never even noticed. I never noticed any of it. But I loved him. I trusted him. He's my husband. And we were supposed to be in this together. But then, I never really was very good at reading people, was I? And he always, always was. Silly me. Silly Aaron. I feel my heart thrashing in my throat as I realize I don't know this man at all. The man I thought I knew, the man I fell in love with, the man I married, he never really existed.
It's gone through, Mark says, nodding, and he pockets the phone. The money has hit our Swiss account. Flash drive, he says, holding it out at arm's length to the tall man. You don't mind if I check too? The man asks, indicating the drive. He wants to make sure it works. He doesn't trust Mark, but then why should he? I don't trust Mark now, and I'm married to him. The man walks away from Mark, careful not to turn his back on him. I see now he's heading towards a black canvas bag left at the clearing's edge. He bends. He pulls out a slim silver laptop. With the laptop open in the crook of his arm, he inserts the flash drive. Both men stand silent in the woods as the sun rises, and they wait for the USB to load. The tall man finally looks up.
You opened it, I see. But you didn't decrypt it. Very wise. That makes things easier, right?
He smiles at Mark, a smile devoid of humor. Mark smirks.
So he lied to me about that too. He didn't decrypt it either. He just guessed.
He has no more idea than I do what's on the USB. He just knows it's worth 2 million euros.
None of my business. I'd rather not know, Mark answers.
The other man seems momentarily distracted. He's focusing on his computer. I wonder what he sees flashing up on that screen. I wonder what secrets worth 2 million euros look like. I suppose I'll never know now.
Happy? Mark asks.
The transaction feels like it's coming to a close.
Yes, happy.
The man places the laptop and USB safely back in his bag. And it's at this point I realize I'm never going to see Mark again. I'll never get to touch him, kiss him. I'll never fall asleep beside him ever again. We'll never watch our children grow up. We'll never move to the countryside and get a big dog. We'll never see a film together or go for a drink. And we'll never grow old together. Every good thing I ever felt was a lie. And now there is no recourse. He took all of our life together from me. And now he'll take the rest of it too. Not that it matters now, really, but he has access to the Swiss account too. I haven't checked it for days. He could have siphoned off all the money already, sent it to another account somewhere. That might be where he's just had the 2 million euros sent. And what was he doing in New York yesterday? He can't have been planning to make an exchange with the Russians because he didn't take the USB with him. Maybe he was just trying to find somewhere to live. Maybe that's where his new life will be. I wonder what he's really been doing for the past 3 weeks. Questions I can't answer. I should have paid more attention. I should have been less trusting. Too late now. Mark will disappear, and I'll be left alone, with nothing but an empty house I can't afford. Or maybe he'll come for me. Maybe he'll want to clear up the loose ends. How long has he been planning this?
I just need the other coordinates now.
An awkward silence. A bird screeches in the distance.
What coordinates? Mark is frowning.
Huh. Mark has no idea what the guy is talking about. I want to laugh. Schadenfreude. He doesn't know the tall man needs the plane coordinates too. That last voicemail, the one I got yesterday morning, only I listened to it. Mark only knows about the USB exchange. He has no idea what coordinates the other man is talking about.
The crash coordinates, the older man replies. He watches Mark expectantly.
Mark doesn't know the coordinates. He wrote them down originally, but I was the one who memorized them, in case we ever needed to go back. It had seemed important at the time, in case someone cared for those people. I burned that information the day I burned everything in connection with the Swiss account in our fire pit. I am the only person in the world who knows where that plane is, where those dead passengers lie. Mark's made a mistake. He doesn't know what to say now. So he'll fake it. He'll bluff. I know it. I know him. The silence lengthens. The tall man is beginning to realize something is not quite right. Mark has created a problem. I hold my breath. Even now, after everything, my heart wants me to shout out and help, but my head screams, shut the fuck up.
The plane coordinates. I asked you for the coordinates of the plane. Where did you find this drive? Where is the plane fuselage? We want the location. You understand?
The situation has shifted up a gear. There's a sense in the air that things are about to go bad. Very bad. Mark has no other hand to play. He doesn't know where the plane is. He must bluff or fold. He tries doing both.
I don't have the coordinates. I don't have them anymore. But I can give you a rough idea of the...
Stop, the man barks.
Stop talking.
Mark obeys. In your message you said you had the coordinates, and now you don't. Please explain to me why, unless you plan to sell the coordinates elsewhere. I hope you understand that this money is for the flash drive and the plane location. You don't get to pick and choose, I'm afraid. You give me the location, or we are going to have a serious problem.
He holds Mark's gaze. He's called his bluff. They stand in silence, the tension building towards something inevitable. In the blink of an eye, the older man's hand dips into his pocket and pulls out a gun.
That's not a surprise. I think we all knew it was there.
The surprise is how swiftly things have escalated. He levels it squarely at Mark. Mark stands frozen, bewildered by this ugly turn of events.
With all my heart, I wish for my gun. But I have no gun. Patrick has it, wherever Patrick is. Instinctively, I glance behind me, but there's no one there. When I look back at the scene, Mark has moved. His body has turned sideways, and in his hand now is a gun. My gun. I see the silver duct tape. Somehow, he's got my Glock from Patrick.
Oh my God.
Mark sent Patrick. That's how Mark took care of me. That's why I wouldn't be a problem. He sent Patrick to take care of me. A small wood pigeon suddenly bursts up into the air behind them, and then a lot of things happen all at once. Mark jolts at the unexpected movement. He must have slid his finger into the trigger bed of the gun because as he jerks in surprise, it discharges, sending a thunderous crack of recoil echoing through the woods.
I told you, Glocks don't have safeties.
The tall man fires almost instantaneously. What he will no doubt later regard as self-defense. As far as he's concerned, Mark's bullet barely missed him, and he fired to protect himself. A red bloom opens in Mark's chest. It happened so fast, and I tried to tell myself I didn't see it. Mark stumbles, one arm flailing out, grasping at a tree. He leans his whole weight into it, but his knees buckle. In a heartbeat, Mark is on the ground, the two gunshots still echoing in my ears. The tall man scans the trees around the clearing before approaching Mark's hand, which now lies outstretched on the mud of the clearing floor. The man bends. Mark is groaning, his breath rasping in and out, frosting in the cold air. The man pockets the Glock, my Glock. I have to clench every muscle in my body as hard as I can to stop myself from screaming. He takes a moment to stare down at Mark. He fires one more time, down into Mark's body. It jerks awkwardly against the leaves. I have stopped breathing. I can't remember when I stopped breathing. Next to me, a dribble of fresh blood trails down my wrist from my balled-up fist. My nails have dug in so hard they've broken the skin. I stay as still as I can. I will not cry. I will not call out. I will not die for Mark. He wouldn't have died for me. I let myself sink down further into the leaves, squeeze my eyes shut and pray for this to be over. I hear rustling in the clearing. As the man wanders about collecting his things, I press my cheek into the musky earth, and then I hear the slow recession of his footsteps, away through the woods, over dead leaves and broken twigs, and then silence. I lie there unmoving for minutes that stretch like decades, but no one comes. After a time, I raise myself slowly. There he lies, in the mud and crumpled leaves, in his best suit and coat. My Mark. Near his motionless body is my rucksack, the rucksack Patrick took. I hadn't noticed it till now. I guess Mark had it all along. I stumble towards him. It's a strange feeling. I'm not sure I can describe it. The love I feel for him is still there. I would do anything to go back in time, but we can't. I approach warily, timidly. If he's still alive, he may try to kill me. Finish what he started. But as I near him, he doesn't stir. And somehow that's worse. I crouch beside him and look at him. The same handsome face, the same hair, lips, eyes, the same warm skin. I gently touch his arm. He doesn't respond. I become braver, lowering my head towards his, my cheek towards his mouth, the reversal of a gesture we've made 1,000 times. But instead of being kissed by him now, I try to feel his warm breath on my cheek. I try to hear it. I bend my head to his chest, careful to avoid the hot, pooling puddle of blood. I hear a gentle, muffled beat. He's still here. He's still alive. I push his hair tenderly back, away from his forehead. Mark? Mark, can you hear me? I whisper. Nothing. I lean closer. Mark? Mark? It's Erin. Can you... And then his eyelids flutter open. He gazes up at me, slow and dazed. He coughs hard and winces deeply at the pain. He's going to die. We only have a moment. His eyes meet mine, and for an instant, like the flashing recognition of an Alzheimer's patient, there's my mark. And then it fades. Another look passes like a cloud across his eyes. He looks at me in a way I'll never forget. I see it now, how he really feels about me. It's fleeting, but irrefutable. And then he's gone. A bird screeches deep in the forest and I flinch. I scan the trees again. There's no one there. I stumble to my feet and stand there, lost, broken, unmoving. And then I grab my rucksack and I run. At first, I don't know where I'm running to, but as I move, the plan forms. Self-preservation kicks in. I need to find a payphone, a phone that can't be traced. Halfway back to the road, I nearly stumble over Patrick's body. He's crumpled to the ground, arms outflung, his throat cut. I run on. Eventually, I reach the road, exhausted, trembling. I tidy myself up, pull my wool hat down low over my injured forehead, wipe Mark's blood from my cheek, and head towards the little village payphone. The time is 6:53. He picks up after 8 rings. Eddie? It's Erin. I'm on a payphone. It went wrong. The wobble in my voice makes my eyes fill with tears. I sound like someone on the news, like a refugee, like a bombing victim. I'm in shock, I guess. Shaky, reedy, breathless, trying desperately to cling to some semblance of normality, even after my entire life has been torn apart. I notice my hand vibrating, poised over the slot, clenching the next coin, and Eddie's crumpled phone number between my trembling fingers. What the fuck just happened?
All right, love, slow down. It's all right now, right? You all right? You safe?
He's with me. His tone, concerned, supportive. It's all going to be okay now. Eddie's here. Yes, I'm fine. My head, but it's okay. I don't know what to do, Eddie. I'm finding it hard to know what to focus on, what's important, how much to say or not say.
About what, love? About what, the money?
He's patient, but I can tell I'm making no sense. He's not a mind reader. And someone else. I don't know what I'm supposed to do. I don't want to go to prison, Eddie. And there it is, the heart of it, the reason I called him and not the police.
It's all right. No questions. Don't say anything else about it. First of all, Erin, I need you to calm down, all right? Can you do that for me, sweetheart?
I think I can hear him getting out of bed, the squeak of springs. Somewhere in Pentonville, 2 bare feet hit the floor. Yes. Okay, I understand. Calm. I struggle to concentrate on my breathing to slow it down. I start to notice the hedges along the road, the early morning hush. I hear the murmur of a yawn down the line and the clang